This is 4:55 on Wednesday, December 5th.
All right. So, if this works out, we will do it later. But want to go ahead and finish talking about IPsec, and then talk about firewalls, and then on Friday we'll have review, and anybody wants to demo, we can do that. And that will wrap things up, except for the final exam. Please visit your MyWSU webpage and do your course evaluations, not only for this class, but for all of them. That's important to us, so we know how things are going. And of course, if you have any comments that you're willing to offer without confidentiality, I'd be appreciative of hearing those as well. But the ones that you do in the course evaluations are, of course, anonymous and confidential. All right. So we were talking about IPsec. Remember, this is the approach to doing security between at the host-to-host level or the network level instead of at the transport level. And we had talked about the sort of transport mode of this that works between end hosts and the tunneling mode that works between routers or between routers and end hosts. Right? So there's authentication header mode, and there's encapsulation security protocol mode for this thing. Authentication header is just, of course, authentication and integrity. ESP is the more widely used one, because these days using encryption on using symmetric key cryptography is not so expensive. I think the idea here was that they were worried that it would be too expensive to use encryption, but this seems to be more appropriate these days. So you can combine these in all different sorts of ways. Tunnel mode and ESP is probably the most common. The problem with host mode is, you know, as I said, to get IPsec to work, you really have to have support in the operating system to begin with. That's not such a big deal these days. You know, everything after Windows XP Service Pack 2 and everything in Linux or BSD or Solaris, they all support it in the operating system. But what is more annoying about all this is that because it's in the operating system, it typically has to be configured by an administrator rather than by the user. And while for our personal machines that's not such a big deal, for shared machines that gets to be a kind of hassle, because different users want to talk to different sites. We're going to see a bazillion options in the way IPsec is configured. And so, as a user, you come along and want to use the machine to talk to a different site, and all of a sudden the administrator has to go to a bunch of work to configure what you need into the system. And so that's kind of been the hassle about IPsec as I've seen it. Managing these things, and this discussion we're going to have now is hopefully going to support that claim that I just made, that it's a hassle for the administrator. So the mechanism, or the name of the mechanism that's used for this, is called security associations. And basically it says, for talking to this host or this class of hosts, I should use a particular set of information that needs to be configured in each endpoint. All right? And for some reason, I mean, again, contributing to the complexity of this thing, the security associations are unidirectional. So you have to get it straight twice in order to get actual communication. We've done this in the lab with some outside entities, and it just takes forever to get this set up to work right. I mean, it's really great once it's done, but it's such a hassle. You've got two security associations associated with traffic in either direction. So it's kind of a connection-oriented thing, right? You're keeping track of it. It's almost operating at a pseudo-transport layer in some ways, because it's keeping track of secrets, numbers, so on and so forth. All right. So what's in a security association? There's got a whole bunch of terminology, of course. Security parameter index. That's just the number of the security association. Where it starts, where it ends, all the information about the kinds of encryption to be used, and keys. Again, this is sort of a cryptographic suite, right? The encryption to be used, the authentication to be used. And all of this is kept in the SAD, the Security Association Database. Now, this is highfalutin terminology for a table in memory, you know. You've got a security association number, you look in the table and you get the information out. All right. And notice that it works in both directions. When you're sending something, you look up who you know, your own sending address or the origin address, you look up the destination address, you find the corresponding SAD entry and use that. You stick something in the SPI, in the IPsec datagram, so that the guy at the other end can tell what he's supposed to do with it. This is very strange. They actually adopted this terminology. This thing is the enchilada. Right? You take your original datagram, you put on the ESP header, and the ESP trailer, and you wrap that all up in a new IP datagram, and the thing that you wrapped up is called the enchilada, as in, I guess, the whole enchilada. Or maybe because enchiladas are things that are wrapped up in stuff. I don't know. You know? Cultural connections. Okay, so you send that across the tunnel. Notice, at least they use the word tunnel in the same way that we used it before. This is a tunnel in the sense that you take something and you wrap it up. You take one IP datagram and you wrap it up in another one and send it where it gets unpacked and then sent on farther. Okay. Well, that's just that's what the picture said. So one of the things that always trips people up with block ciphers is that, remember, a block cipher requires that information come in blocks of a certain size, say 64 bytes. And if you don't have 64 bytes worth of data, if you don't have an even multiple of 64 bytes of data, you have to actually pad out your data to incorporate, to make it up to a multiple of 64 bytes. And yet, You also have to be able to figure out what the original data was. So somehow associated with your padding, you also have to have room for a padding length, and you also, it turns out, need to be able to point to the original IP header. But that's okay. The trick is that you know, you may start out with something that's exactly the right length, but because you have to put the pad length on somewhere, you have to be able to say zero, and so now the thing that was exactly the right length has actually grown by almost 64 bytes in order to be able to say there's no padding. You know, just one of the unfortunate things about block size.
What kind of information is included as padding? Is it just garbage?
It's just zeros, garbage.
Okay, I was just wondering if that actually represents some sort of a weakness, something that's predictable.
I suppose it ought to be random, oughtn't it? You ought to fill it with random stuff.
It would seem that way. Otherwise, yeah. It's just, you know.
It's sort of giving away, potentially giving away information that is it's not necessary to give away. Yeah, I actually have never implemented this for encryption. I've implemented it for hashing and sort of gone through the pain of this. But for hashing, since there's no key, it doesn't. Okay, we use sequence numbers. This is to prevent duplication of the replay attacks. And notice, all right. So one way to keep track of sequence numbers is to remember everything you've got, right? But that gets expensive. You have to more and more state as this thing runs on. So again, the idea of a window is kind of important here. It says I'm keeping track of everything in this space, and so if I've seen it before, I'll know because I've kept track of all those packets. But if I get something that's too far ahead and I'm still missing one, I'm going to not accept it because that would force me to sort of forget something else that I should be remembering. So you won't just accept arbitrary things. The other database involved here is the security policy database. Remember, every security association has a particular set of encryption and stuff associated with it. But when we're faced with a new connection happening, we have to choose which we have to make a new security association. We have to figure out what the parameters are associated with that, and that's what SPD does. Okay. So, in theory, Trudy is prevented from doing all of these things with IPsec, and I think people generally believe that works, right? that IPsec actually does provide good security between hosts once you can get it set up. And so, in the power industry, where I'm familiar with what is being done with this, it has been so complicated to get set up that the Department of Energy actually funded a couple of companies to sort of sit down and figure out what a good set of parameters were for these associations, and then encouraged other companies, and once they'd figure that out, then they sort of convinced other companies to use those as the default settings in their products so that it would be easier to make these IPsec things work. because it was such a pain a couple of years ago.
Why was that funded by the Department of Energy in particular?
Because they wanted particularly the electric power and the gas companies to actually be able to use this stuff, and it wasn't working. Right? People were just sort of not able to make progress on building infrastructures that used IPsec because it was such a pain. I remember here that Dave Anderson, our lab manager, spent hours on the phone with Idaho National Lab trying to get our IPsec configuration to talk to their IPsec configuration. And of course, when you've got people working for different companies, they don't necessarily feel a great obligation to answer the phone when somebody else calls, and sort of it just drags on and on and on. So hopefully some of this stuff will be easier to deploy, but it, it still is the case that it doesn't, as the end user, it's much better for sort of infrastructure-y things than it is for end users. I mean, you couldn't really, I think, build the World Wide Web using IPsec, because it's too much administrator stuff and too much particular point-to-point stuff that's needed. So SSL has worked very well at the application layer. I'm going to skip over this section on IKE. It's sort of the application of PKI to IPsec. So we won't do that. WEP, wired equivalent privacy. In other words, none for wireless. Sorry. I don't want to talk about that because its use is deprecated. Deprecated is the word, not depreciated. I see that sometimes. Deprecated means it exists, but don't use it. Problem being that just about anybody with a software toolkit that's widely available in various forms on the internet can break your WEP wireless protection. So don't use it. Instead, extensible authentication protocol. This is what WSU Wireless is using these days. Much better, but much more of a pain in the neck. Again, another pain in the neck to get working right, as the lug can probably tell you. All right. Well, they don't even talk about that very much. But one thing that is interesting about this is that our mobile hosts now interact with the wireless access points, which, using this EAP protocol, actually are able to not have to have any information locally about authentication, and instead gather information from the interaction with the mobile and send it over the wired network to a so-called RADIUS server, which that's an acronym which stands for something, but it's a security protocol in itself. So we only need one point of authentication now to do to decide whether people are allowed onto the network or not. Okay, so that's an improvement, except that the complication of this protocol for the wireless nodes means that things like old Android systems and sort of various oddball stuff doesn't know how to do these new protocols. And often, even when they think they do, they don't, because it's so complicated. There are so many variants, and different campuses use different variants of this. So a system that works on one campus may not work on another one. Yes? Yes. PEAP. P-E-A-P. Yeah. Which protects the negotiation part better than this does. So, yeah.
So, since you said it was, is it mostly that it's just difficult to implement that, which is why like most things don't have it? Because I've tried to like connect to the wireless here with like other things, like the Kindle and my phone and stuff, and none of them really like. Like, the phone kind of does it, and then the Kindle flat out fuses, too.
Oh, really? Well, that's bad news.
But, like, my laptop works fine.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think it's just a matter of there are so many different variations that nobody except the sort of best-funded people have the ability to test their stuff in all variants of it. I know the Linux systems sort of don't work with this very well. There's workarounds to make it work, but it doesn't work in the way that it's intended. The intended capability of the WSU network is that the laptops, the mobile devices, can actually authenticate that they're really attaching to the WSU network. And that part just doesn't work a lot of the time for anything other than Windows and Mac hosts. Maybe not even for Macs, I don't know. But and it has to do with the certificates and having all the certificates that are needed and how they're chained together and who knows what. But it just, you know, so the solution for the Linux, in the Linux world, has been to turn off the authentication of the network to the device. The authentication of the device to the network is working okay, but, you know, it's broken. It's just, the world is broken because it's too complicated. Firewalls. Anybody played with firewalls? Probably if you have a home router, you have a firewall. What?
A little port forwarding
and that stuff. Well, okay, so let's talk about, first of all, the theory of the firewall. And then we'll talk about some practicalities. So, the idea is that you have a computer that sits between, essentially on a router that connects the public internet to the network that you're administering. And that computer, as being a part of this router, is able to potentially look at all the traffic that is coming in or going out and inspect the packets and say, based on some policies that you set up, whether that's to be allowed or not allowed or rerouted or logged or various things. So, what do we want to do? We want to keep out the bad stuff. And we want to keep people inside sometimes from doing bad things by going outside. So basically what we have to do is look at the traffic and decide what we're going to do with each and every packet. That's the goal. Three types, stateless packet filters, stateful packet filters. I don't think there's much in the way of stateless being made anymore, even for home routers. Stateful packet filters and application gateways. So, a stateless packet firewall just looks at each packet and looks at usually the transport layer information, not just the network information, but the transport layer information. It says what are the port numbers? Are we trying to make a connection? And based on what we see there, we just decide to forward or drop. Don't want to do that. Too stateful. A stateful packet filter looks at that same information, but it keeps track of what it's seen up to now and makes its decision based not only on what it's seeing in each packet, but also the information that it has in its table of essentially connections. So with a stateful packet filter, you can even sort of accommodate things that look like UDP connections, whereas in the stateless one you couldn't. So for example, suppose that I want to allow UDP traffic outgoing and replies to those outgoing messages. So I won't accept a incoming UDP packet unless I've previously seen an outgoing UDP packet for the same source, destination, address, and ports. Okay? You can also determine whether things make sense and throw out things that have already happened. Yeah.
The incoming outgoing, don't they just keep the connection open, or is it not really based on the connection? Open?
Well, think about what a connection is. A TCP connection is really nothing more than an agreement between the host inside and the host outside about port numbers and sequence numbers. There isn't anything that really amounts to in between a connection, except that at the firewall, where by recording that same information, the firewall can use it to make decisions about outgoing or not. So there really isn't, you know, there really isn't anything that you could call a connection typically at a router, unless you do something like this. Access control list then is the policy that describes how what rules the firewall should follow, and can say whether it's supposed to look at the established state of a connection or not. So let's see here. I wonder. Yeah, I think this is probably still active. Yes. That's weird. Somehow I feel like it's not SSHP, it's SSH server. Pardon?
You were just disconnected.
Oh, okay. What's going on here? WSU wireless.
Well, I guess I won't demonstrate this. On my office machine, I have actually set up a local firewall using the facilities present in the Linux IP tables firewall facilities to protect the machine against certain kinds of incoming traffic that was annoying it a while back, probably still is. I don't think it's blocking this connection, however. I think there's something else going on here. Within Linux, there is, within the kernel implementation, there is the complete ability to implement a firewall that looks very much like this one. You say for particular protocol, source address, destination address, ports, whatever, what you want to do with the packets depending on what state the connection is in. And you can say, you know, you can say log it, you can say throw it away, you can say let it happen, so on. Yeah.
So would a webgate be basically a firewall? Once you're in, you don't have to worry about the firewall.
A webgate.
So basically this summer I put a webgate in front of my server. I was running on Windows Server 2008. And I had to use the iSAFI filters.
Uh-huh.
So basically I had to put the iSAFI filters, they filter them, and when they find one they want, they call the DLL. And once you're in, you don't have to worry about filtering anymore. But yeah, once you're past that filter, you're inside the web gate, and you can access all, for Boeing, you can get into all their sites.
Okay.
Or you could get into that.
Well, I mean, that sounds more like a VPN sort of setup. Maybe. I don't know.
But I just know I had to allow, you know, a filter with the ISAP.
Mm-hmm. That part sounds like a firewall. But then once you've connected through it, you can do anything, then that sounds like a VPN. I don't know. I don't know that one. So the other thing that people used to do, I think, more than they do now, was maybe they still do, I don't know. But I don't think so. We used to use fairly simple firewalls that basically said, don't let any traffic go out, except from a few hosts that we trust. And we implemented a particular host for each different protocol that we wanted to let go out. So, for example, for Telnet, in order to telnet to an outside machine, you would tunnel it basically through a gateway that was specific to the telnet protocol. For web services, you would have here your web proxy server, your internal web proxy server, and you would only let the web proxy server go out through the firewall and nobody else could. This kind of design is still used in situations where you really know what's supposed to be going on your network and what traffic is supposed to be going out through the router. And if it's a very limited set, then you can use this design. but for, well, it's another hassle, actually, right? Because if you allow, say, Telnet to go out through the firewall here,
directly from the machines, then the machines don't have to know anything about this application gateway. Right? It just sort of transparently happens. The firewall implements the policy, whatever it is that you want about telnet and who you can go to or not and so forth. And the end machine never has to know anything about it. But if you use an application gateway, think about what you had to do in your browsers for the proxies, using your own proxy server, right? You had to go into your browser, you had to change a setting to point it at your proxy server. Well, think about what you would have to do if you were doing that with a dozen or 100 different protocols, and all the machines that had to be configured to do that, and so on and so forth. So that's the application gateway idea. There's kind of a hybrid of these two things, which is actually what EECS runs, and it's a real downer. We run a firewall that transparently proxies web traffic. That is, it doesn't actually just pass through the web requests and responses, but rather says, when I send a web request out through the firewall, it says, well, that's a web request, and I'm gonna proxy for that. So I will actually not send your packet. I'll send one of mine. I'll see the response coming back. I'll look inside the response and decide whether I think it's okay, and only then send it onward to the actual client. And it's so badly implemented that lots of legal stuff just fails to go through it. I run into enough sites that I want to use for stuff that it just throws up its hands, and like it doesn't understand zipped tar files as responses to web requests and won't let them through. Well, that's a pain, you know what? So anyway, that's another technique that gets used there. The limitations of IP itself sort of come back and haunt the firewall story. You can't really know where anything comes from on the internet. Anybody can make up an IP address and send as if that were their address. These are the gateway stuff that I was talking about. Stateful firewalls really fix this issue about UDP. But the greater concern is nobody really knows what the rules should be. It's really hard to establish rules that provide good protection and at the same time don't get in the way of people doing the work that they really want to do. The other problem is that the way the rules in these firewalls are typically designed is not very conducive to actually understanding what the rules say in terms of the policy. The rules in a firewall, let's go back to here. The rules in a firewall are usually expressed in a sort of language that boils down to a table that looks like this. But the way that they work is that they say, look at this rule, and if it applies, do whatever it says. If it doesn't apply, go on to the next rule. and do the same thing over and over again. So the actual policy implemented by a set of firewall rules can only be understood by understanding not just the rules themselves, but the order in which they occur. Right? And that's for a firewall that has even hundreds of rules, that's usually beyond the capability of the human brain to understand. So we don't actually often see that the rules implement the policy that people had in mind for the firewall. So that's one issue. The other issue is that in many companies there are firewalls layered on firewalls, right? So like at WSU, there's a firewall at the point where the internet enters campus, and then there's a firewall at EECS that implements another set of rules. And the actual behavior that we get depends on the rules in both places. And what do they really say? Nobody knows, right? Because nobody will even share their firewalls from one place to the other, their firewall rule sets from one place to the other. So firewalls are just anyway. They seem to be essential, but it's not a pretty sight. Intrusion detection systems. Usually, this runs. So a firewall sits between. What did I do here? Configuration of a firewall is typically like this. The firewall looks at all the packets and decides what to do with them. An intrusion detection system would typically be placed somewhere inside the intranet, and similarly to the firewall, actually inspect all the traffic. Maybe at a deeper layer, a deeper level than the firewall typically does. It may sort of get into the actual application level protocols. And may actually do correlation between different packets. And the idea is to try to tell the network administrator whether something evil is going on the network or not, and hopefully give a chance to respond to it. The big issue with IDSs is false positives. Right? Typically, people who deploy IDSs complain that the IDS is constantly spewing indicators of intrusions that either are not really intrusions or are not considered significant enough that you actually have to do anything about them. And at the same time, there's big concerns about the possibility that people, insiders, people on the inside of the firewall, are themselves evil and doing bad things that they shouldn't be doing, and people wonder whether IDSs actually pick that up or not. So all of these things suggest that security in the network world is not a pretty sight. And the Poland police say that we're having another round of stolen credit cards. So,
Dismore's again, or somewhere else?
They're not convinced it was only Dismore. So, or was ever Dismore's for that matter? Yeah.
Oh, did you ever get that email?
Oh, did I? Let's see.
That's right. We were going to try to do something here. Skylar says... Tell you what, we're really out of time. So I will check and see if this I can run this, and we'll do it on Friday. Okay? So on Friday, we'll do some review for the exam, and